Welcome to the Midstory Hour, a show produced by Midstory in collaboration with WGTE. I'm your host, Samuel Chang. This week, we're doing something a little different. We're bringing you straight into the season finale of our podcast, Brain Drain. You may think it's the end, but we see it as the beginning of new conversations, new stories, new opportunities. Then, stay with us for a conversation with the award-winning public media producer, Dan Gettyman, who produced a brand new Ohio Humanities podcast, The Copperhead Conspiracy.
Wait, am I allowed to talk yet? Because I've not been introduced. Oh, because I was going to keep prompting, but I was like, I realize if I'm like not introduced yet, then who even am I? Like, no one right now.
Just a voice. That's true. Okay, maybe I should introduce interns.
Oh, yeah, should we go to the next one?
That disembodied voice belongs to Rajan Carson, one of the Midstory interns who worked on this podcast. We heard from him all the way back in episode 3. Our interns were a massive help on the show, and we also felt like it would be important to include their voices, not just to reward them for their hard work, but also because they're a part of the story of Brain Drain in Toledo.
Should I do the first line?
How do you feel?
I think it was good.
They're the young, educated people this city says it's trying to attract. As we've heard in the previous 6 episodes, that effort hasn't really panned out. At least, not yet. But these young professionals did make it to Toledo, even if they only stayed a short while. We've already heard their perspective on living, working, and playing in this city, but we also wanted to know what it felt like to help make this podcast. What their time in Toledo meant to them.
Can I talk about the interviews that I did, or is that not, it's all fair game?
Yeah, all fair game.
Okay.
In the last 8 years, Midstory has brought over 200 young people just like them to Toledo through our internship and fellowship programs. They may only stay here for 2 months or a year, and their experiences may be limited, but they're exactly the kind of young talent Toledo needs. And maybe it's the right time to hear about what they have to say about our city. Because regardless of whether you agree, their perspective is something we can learn from.
Welcome to the season finale of Brain Drain, a brand new Midstory production that presents an average American city through the eyes of the people who've left it behind.
I'm Daya Kukeli.
I'm Yannick Schaller. Episode 7, You Will Do Better in Toledo. Part 1. The interns. Allow me to present our lovely interns in the order you'll hear from them in this episode.
I'm Martin Barreto. I go to Syracuse University. I'm a senior. I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio, but I moved to Toledo when I was 5 years old, and I've been here ever since.
Hi, I'm Yasu. I go to Oberlin College, though I'm originally from Charlottesville, Virginia.
My name is Anavi Prakash. I am a rising junior at Northwestern University studying journalism and social policy. I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, so also in the Midwest.
Hi, my name is Rajan. I am from Atlanta, Georgia, and I've lived there my entire life. And I'm a rising senior at Duke University.
Now, let's be clear. Our interns do come from all different backgrounds and upbringings, but we also recognize that they're highly educated and that they see Toledo and the concept of brain drain from a very specific perspective. This is a point that Jeff Schaff emphasized too. Remember, he's the vice president of talent and strategy at the Toledo Chamber of Commerce. We heard from him in episode 6. Jeff's argument is that zeroing in on the grievances of this specific demographic of highly educated young people paints an incomplete picture of Toledo. Yes, those folks have been leaving, but Jeff says that the city is much more than the place that those people think they're leaving behind. Noted. But all that being said, interns like Martin, Yasu, Anavi, and Rajan are a lot like the people Toledo is losing. They spent a summer imagining what a Toledo that included them might look like, and comparing that to the city they saw in front of them. Their impressions didn't always line up with the perspectives of proud Toledoans.
That comes to head in a lot of the interviews, at least that I've done, where...
Here's Martin.
This isn't something that I try to intentionally set up, But we talk about the issues that people have in Toledo. We talk about like the difficulties of their job, the difficulties of like the arts in Toledo and like attracting young people to Toledo. And it felt like it reached a point where they felt the need to defend then Toledo, where the next like whatever 15, 20 minutes was them being like, well, yeah, we do have all these issues and these challenges, but like Toledo's actually great. So like the this inclination to defend Toledo maybe against like some of the rational things that they might think is definitely like a prevalent issue.
I've noticed the same thing as Marty. Like, I feel like a lot of the interviews we did, particularly, and I think it really, there's a generational thing. Like, I feel like younger people are a lot more lukewarm about Toledo, while like older people, like kind of, you know, very, very gung-ho about Toledo. I feel like there's something admirable about like, you know, having that much, you know, this sort of like attitude of you're going to stick with a place regardless of like, you know, what it's like.
Yasu's hitting on that good old Toledo loyalty. He's right. There definitely is something special about sticking with your city through thick and thin. But there are clear pitfalls with that mentality, too. Darren Moore, the Ottawa Hills town council member who we heard from in episode 6, talked about this at length. He said that this unwavering allegiance to Toledo can sometimes trick people into celebrating minor victories while the alarm bells are ringing. But there's another knock-on effect of that extreme loyalty, namely what happens when Toledo boosters come into contact with people who don't have that same level of devotion to this city. These could be encounters for constructive conversation on how Toledo could improve. Instead, they're usually dead ends. Anavi witnessed this phenomenon firsthand.
When we talk to a lot of kind of the officials of Toledo, a lot of people say like, oh, we have everything here in Toledo, but people just aren't coming here to find it. And so they first are putting it on like other people to kind of come in, like they've kind of done their job and it's up to everyone else to kind of just fall into place, it felt. They're like, people are leaving, but we have everything here. So like, it doesn't make any sense simply. And so I think that adds to a lot of pessimism. And that's something that Nicole Pfeiffer from the Center of Regional Development, she was saying that it's kind of like this very overarching mindset around locals in Northwest Ohio is just this pessimism that, oh, we don't deserve more, so we're just going to accept what we can get.
That kind of brought up a point that I wanted to talk about where I feel like a lot of people I have spoken to mention like climate change and how this area is going to end up being like safe haven and like the Great Lakes, yeah, which is always like kind of a mix of like depressing but also like, all right, I'm good. Like, if I stay here, like I guess I'll survive. Like, that's a weird feeling to have, but it kind of makes me think about like the idea of like waiting for this perception to get better, waiting for like development. Like, at what point do you go for something that maybe already exists versus waiting for it to become what you want it to become?
For many of the young people we spoke to this season who were in Toledo, living in this city had become something of a waiting game. Even some of the most committed Toledoans, the people who said they could see good things on the horizon, admitted that there's always this lingering sense of doubt. Jalen Toll, the DJ from episode 2, believes that downtown Toledo holds real promise, but also worries that one day he'll wake up and realize that he's wasted his youth on this city. Mel Monaghan, the recent Ohio State grad, worked downtown for a while, but in the end, she decided that she couldn't keep on believing that she was bound to find some community eventually. These are people who aren't sure that they have the patience or the stamina to endure the wait for Toledo's tomorrow. But we're also wondering about the effect that all that waiting can have on a city. If Toledo's young people are just holding on to the hope that their lives here will improve, it's hard to imagine that this will someday become a place that actually meets their needs. If Toledo is going to attract the sort of talent that has the desire and the ability to transform the city, the sales pitch can't be that this place is already everything a young person could ever want. Judging by what we've heard over the last 6 episodes, I think it's fair to say that if we want to tell people you will do better in Toledo, Toledo will have to do better first. But like Ayendi Bonifacio spoke about back in episode 5, That doesn't mean that Toledo has to let go of itself completely. This city has plenty of assets and a proud history filled with economic, political, and social success. If Toledo loosens its white-knuckled grip on the past, that past can offer the city more than just a hit of nostalgia. It can be a reference point, a benchmark for how far this place has already come, a source of inspiration for a new generation of Toledoans to draw from as they reshape the city. Our interns came up against the weight of Toledo's past a lot in their reporting, and it definitely left an impression on them. Here's Yasu again, who hadn't been to Toledo before joining the cohort last summer.
But I also do think the perspective that someone like us, who have like just come here recently, like maybe lack is like the perspective of like the perspective of time and the perspective that like I think particularly like when people were talking about like the downtown of Toledo, it sounds like it has like improved a lot. And like I think some of the pride might be in, you know, the fact that things have improved. And I feel like that is maybe something that would be missed by someone who is not from here, is sort of where things have come from and like sort of how much, also how much work it took to get things where they are.
Yasu's right. If you just parachute into a city like Toledo, you're not going to have the same perspective as someone who has spent real time living and growing within this community. You're probably more likely to feel that knee-jerk reaction, to jump to conclusions. If you don't know what Toledo used to be, you're more likely to criticize this place for what it isn't, rather than appreciate it for what it is. Toledoans are proud of their community, and in many ways, they have every right to be.
Before we wrap up, we wanted to give the interns a chance to take a step back from Toledo. We asked them to imagine the place they'd want to settle down in. What would that city look like?
When you guys think about like your ideal place to live, I don't know, what are like the top three categories?
I'll start before I start the 10 seconds. I'm an irrational party. Don't think rationally. I love mystique. Mystique is a big thing.
Mystique.
I love mystique. Mystique's huge. I guess a job kind of has to be there for me to go there. Mystique, job, and then I'll just say mystique and job. Why not?
That's it?
I think so. I'm pretty open-minded about where it is that I go. I don't have any places that I would super cross off the list. Actually, you know what? I think that politics also has something to do with it. And I think for YP is that's also true.
YP is shorthand for Young Professional. It's actually an acronym that Epic Toledo uses. Our team just adopted it.
Yasu and I were kind of having a conversation about this the other day, but that the identity that comes with political beliefs bleeds into a lot of other cultural things. So this isn't to say that I want to be in some kind of like echo chamber, but people that I would agree with politically, I think I would also get along with in other sort of ways and perhaps be able to like feel more empowerment in terms of the things that are happening in whatever community I go to.
I think I want a place that feels like very warm and inviting.
Here's Rajan.
But I think the main thing is more, I think a certain like diversity in the people that I see like around me like in a new city, I think would also be like very crucial. I think especially because like where I grew up, and not just like racial diversity, but just like all kinds of different people, especially people like moving to a region, and because it was like a very fast growing area, I think I liked that never like felt stagnant. Like there was always new things going on. There was like, again, like all kinds of like restaurants, food, just like things to do, different attractions, whatever.
I'm in a bit of a particular situation because the place that I want to end up next is not necessarily a place that conforms with the things that I prioritize in a city. So, irrational actor, but I think I'll explain myself. So the place that I want to end up next is Los Angeles. And the reason I want to end up there is because my partner lives there. And I do wonder about how much my relationship status has affected and impacted my ability to find community here. But that's, I think, a little bit besides the point. The point is that the city that I want to live in has great public transit, is a walkable city, and has snow.
Oh, for three.
And Los Angeles has none of those things. But I think the reason that I can like still have a lot of enthusiasm and excitement about the idea of a move to Los Angeles says to me that the sort of like rational priorities we set for ourselves aren't always the end all be all, because there are other things beyond the priorities I care most about that can really make a place suitable and rewarding and rich. The difficult thing is that I don't really know how to quantify that, and I don't really know for sure until I'm there, whether or not this place that doesn't necessarily align with my interests and goals for myself could show me something about myself that I hadn't expected to see.
Well, is that is love rational? Is love? Where does that fall under this thing? Because I think a lot of people in Toledo would like make that kind of claim too. Like family, when we talk to people of why they live in Toledo, is like a big thing. They want to love and care for their family. I think like romantic partners is like a similar thing.
I think you're right in that like connection can override a whole lot of the things that you think would have otherwise been important for you. I think it's a lot of the reason that a lot of people have stayed in Toledo longer than they thought they would.
In taking on this project, Yannick and I knew that we needed to treat this place and these people with respect and humility. We've been working on this podcast for more than a year now, and those principles have guided our storytelling from the very start.
I know that there are many aspects of life in Toledo that I, as a relative newcomer to the community, will never understand as fully as someone whose roots here run deep and who has no intention of leaving. But at the same time, I have belonged to Toledo. I have given myself to this city. My contributions are shaped by what I've learned through living in other places before coming here, and by the knowledge that I haven't found everything I'm looking for in Toledo. But we believe that anybody who chooses to spend meaningful time in this city should be given the opportunity to share their experience in Toledo and help imagine its future. Our organization was founded on this conviction. This podcast is the story that Midstory was made for. It's time to pull back the curtain. Like we said at the beginning of the season, Daya and I feel that we are the right people to tell this story. But it would be more accurate to say that we feel that we're just two of many. Toledo is full of the right people for this story. Meg Monaghan is the right person, but so is her niece, Mel.
Jake Vrieslar is, and Chris Eichen.
The whole Lee family, Trevor and Hannah and Stevie too.
Ash Lehman, Jeff Schaff, Jalen Toll.
The dozens of other Toledoans we had the chance to interview for this podcast in the last year, and the thousands more we didn't get to speak with.
Our amazing interns are the right people, as are the people who set all of this in motion 8 years ago, when they bubbled back up the brain drain, returned to Toledo, and founded Midstory.
Well, look at us!
Thanks for inviting us to your podcast.
It's no big deal.
Also, is it going to get a lot of listens? Like, can you give me some stats? I only go on podcasts that have at least 100K subscribers.
So we're still working on that. Okay. But it's looking very promising at the moment. And you guys being on is just going to be...
I met Sam, Logan, and Ruth by accident. I applied for Midstory's fellowship after overhearing some people talking about it at an improv class. Next thing I knew, I was sitting in a coffee shop on a chilly winter day for an interview, facing the three of them and talking about my aspirations. For much of my life, those aspirations didn't end here in Toledo. Midstory made me rethink that. Sitting in that coffee shop, seeing other young people who could be anywhere, make a home in Toledo, stirred something inside of me, too. Maybe it's not all logical. Maybe it's not the rising job opportunities, the affordable housing market, the growing social scene, the ease of traveling from Toledo, and so on and so forth. Maybe it's not the parks, or the zoo, the museums, or the concerts. Those things all help, but there is still something more. Something like a calling. Part 2, the Midstory.
So to start us off, I'm just going to have you guys introduce yourselves.
Okay, so I'll go first. My name is Ruth. I am a co-founder and now also creative director of Midstory. My background's in architecture. I have a degree from Princeton and also from Harvard in architecture. And so that's been helpful for this endeavor.
My name's Logan. I am the editorial director here at Midstory. And prior to that, I got my degree from Princeton in comparative literature and Chinese language and culture. Had a little bit of background and experience in journalism and brought all those things here to Midstory, which has been lovely.
My name is Sam, and I am the co-founder and president of Midstory. My background is in public and international affairs, and I was working in prison education in Boston before coming back to Toledo to start Midstory.
I've heard Sam, Logan, and Ruth talk about Midstory a lot. And one thing they always say is that Midstory really began with their own story, one of finding home, leaving home, and ultimately returning home. Throughout this podcast, we've talked about many of the tangible reasons people have left or stayed. Opportunity, career, money, social life, culture, family. But this episode will explore some of the more intangible reasons. Midstory didn't come into existence because Toledo's a promising place to start a nonprofit. It's not. Or even because some of Midstory's founders grew up here. They didn't start Midstory from trust funds or with the intention of padding their resumes. Midstory's here for deeply personal reasons and exists in the belief that there is something inherently meaningful in giving oneself to serve a higher calling.
I want to start off with a question you probably get a lot, which is, what is Midstory?
Beyond the mission that we submitted to the IRS, Midstory is really about reimagining and re-envisioning what the story of our region looks like. And that's both what it looks like to ourselves as we begin to craft that narrative and how we see ourselves, but also how the rest of the nation and even the world views us as well. I mean, we always had this like kind of crazy pipe dream that if, you know, people across the United States can read some off-Broadway theater review in the beginning pages of the New Yorker, and they're in California or in Ohio or somewhere across the globe, they're never gonna see this show. They don't live in New York, but they're reading it because they realize its significance culturally, socially, politically. And I think we always dreamed that there could be one of those for the Midwest. And why not? I mean, why shouldn't people across the region, across the world, be reading stories from our region and understanding the significance of this region in a national context?
And then in 2016, of course, I think Logan was alluding to the election and the political rifts that we saw happen in the country. That was really made obvious then. And a lot of my friends were like confused about, you know, why people were voting certain ways. I'm like, well, I'm from that area. You know, like, if you want to know why, you probably need to go there. I think, you know, we were sort of challenging ourselves too, of like, can we move back home? Because it's not really expected and it's not really possible in many ways. And I think just because we had that thought of like, why not? I think we wanted to give it a go.
I'd love to hear that scene, that story of actually finally coming back, where you guys were, what you were thinking, what you were feeling in that moment in time when you returned to the city.
It was in 2018, you know, and I was out on the East Coast. I was working in 7 to 8 different correctional facilities, and Ruth was, she just got a job working at an architecture firm in Boston. Logan just graduated. Alex was my roommate at the time, and he just graduated from MIT. His background's in bioengineering. And, you know, when you're on the East Coast, there's a certain kind of stigma that people have towards, you know, the Midwest, but specifically Ohio too, like Corn Belt, Rust Belt. We came together, we were at a very certain crossroads in our life, and we were like, can we do something for this region? And what was really missing was giving this region a voice that could be connected with national narratives and dialogues, conversations that are happening. What we realized was how disconnected we were as a region to those stories. And I think we felt that we wanted to come home and begin to bridge those gaps and to tell those stories from a more authentic perspective. So I wrote my boss a resignation letter and I said, I'm gonna try something different. And my boss gave me a look And he's like, are you sure about this? A lot of my friends still give me that look to this day because people think we're crazy, all four of us, for dropping our endeavors on the East Coast to come to Toledo, Ohio.
I mean, people were interested or sort of maybe inspired in an ideal sense.
The idea of middle America.
Exactly. Right? This idea of middle America. And I always thought that was really interesting because people were interested in it, right? Mm-hmm. But interest doesn't equate to action. And so I think like actually making the move home, I think a lot of our peers were pretty surprised, like why Ohio? As is often the question that many of our interns and fellows get when they come to join us. Mm-hmm. Why the heck are you going to Ohio after graduation? And maybe in the beginning it was like, we'll give ourselves a year. And then eventually it was like, we'll give ourselves 2 years. And then we'll give ourselves 5 years. And that was kind of like, okay, if we're still around and things are going well in 5 years, we'll know that we've made the right decision.
Fast forward 5 years, and their resolve had only strengthened. But that didn't mean that there weren't challenges.
I think we had spent a lot of time in the first couple of years thinking that we could survive in and of Toledo, and very quickly realized that, you know, funding opportunities were limited, that we would need to expand if we wanted to grow as quickly as we were hoping to. And the pandemic honestly catalyzed that by allowing us to do projects in other places at that time without even leaving our homes. But eventually now, a lot of our projects are outside the area. I mean, we're still stubbornly here in Toledo and insisting that all the investment that we're making and including other projects in other places, that's benefiting Toledo. But also recognizing that in order to put Toledo on the map, we needed to set our sights bigger.
That meant looking elsewhere, expanding stories, projects, and funding across the Great Lakes region, traveling, establishing partnerships with universities and institutions across the nation, competing on a bigger scale.
I would say that it's funny because maybe Toledo's not used to having nice things. And I'm not saying we're nice things, but I think that Midstory, we want to produce things that are beautiful and responsible and engaging and visionary
and
exciting.
Competitive,
high quality. And we ensure, however slow we may be sometimes, we ensure that anything that goes out into the world through our hands is all of those things.
I think what Toledo and this region really lacks is competition. You know, when you only have, two or three Chinese restaurants in the whole of Toledo, they can serve whatever takeout food that they want, and there's no competition for the most authentic Shanghainese fried rice or whatever. But if you go to LA, if you go to Chicago, and your menu is like General Tso's chicken and chicken fried rice, like you're not going to survive out there because you have to be authentic, or you have to have something that makes you stand out. Here, media, I'm using food as a metaphor, but media is the same thing. You know, we only have one or two institutions locally, and it really doesn't matter what kind of food we're putting on the table. It's just food, you know? And because there's no competition, there's no one checking your quality. We believe in quality and the kinds of content that we do. I mean, we believe that we can compete with some of these big name institutions that we see on the coasts, and we want to be able to compete. And we believe a region like Toledo should not be left behind and always be looked at as a second rate or third rate city.
Toledo's not LA. It's not New York. That's a line we've heard over and over again in our reporting for this podcast. But that doesn't mean this place can't be more than it currently is. And there are aspects of life in other high-profile cities that actually aren't out of reach, even in Toledo.
You know, when you talk about New York, it's got this, like, whatever, vibe, in quotes. And I feel like we want that. And you can't fabricate that kind of, like, cultural, like, resonance that happens. It's not just one person talking about it. It's a lot of people talking about it. And the more people talk about it, the more people argue about it, the more that sort of like itself becomes a cultural movement or whatever. You know, there's an understanding about a place that comes from that conversation. And I feel like we need that kind of narrative to come from the Midwest, and it needs to be one that's told from the people on the ground and not from other places looking at. So I think it's great that people are interested, like what Logan mentioned earlier about, oh, it's like this sort of interesting esoteric project. But it can't just be a project from outside, right? It should be something that is on the ground. And a lot of people just go to other places to take. Here, the question is, how much do you have to give to want to be here?
I think as much as I think your question's a really good one, I don't want to have to ask people to sacrifice to be here. When we talk about Toledo to our interns, to our fellows, to prospective people coming in, we don't talk about it like it's a sacrifice, because we are trying to create the community that we want to see here, and also to be generous in the ways that we think about our region. When we talk to leaders in Cleveland, the kind of programs they're able to do, even sort of similar to what we're doing, like they bring in young people every summer for internships. They like give them housing. They, you know, take care of this, the experience of people that are coming into Cleveland for the summer. They're like, you know, hosting these big events and, you know, developing the waterfront and doing all these amazing things because they're able to bring leaders together to say, hey, we should do this. I have this crazy idea. It might not work, but we should try. And that's how we move our community forward. I'm not saying Toledo doesn't have that at certain scales. I think some of the development is great, right? Metro Parks is doing great stuff on the riverfront. We have incredible parks. We have an incredible zoo. We have a beautiful museum. We have great assets. We have a low cost of living. But at the end of the day, even you offer someone a salary and you have all those things, these kids are still not staying here and they're not coming here. But I would say all in all, in terms of our ability to take some risks in this community, is what's limiting us from being able to retain young people.
I kind of want to ask you all of you a bit more about the internship program and the fellowship program that's part of this organization's mission. What's the purpose of bringing those young people to Toledo, even if they're going to leave after a summer or after a year? What's the value that that sort of program generates for a community like this?
We have had a good amount of very important people or business leaders or community leaders ask us that very same question, right? We talk about our internship program, we talk about our fellowship program, and they're like, great, so how many of them stay in Toledo? But I just think that's such a wrong question to be asking. We are the only institution bringing in this level of talent to a place like Toledo. And if you're gonna ask us how many of them are staying, I would ask them, why are you not making Toledo a place that they can stay? Like, we're doing our job, you know? Like, this is something that we really believe in, that first of all, for the sake of our community, the work they're putting in alone, which I'm not sure people really recognize, is to spend 2 months to a year of their life dedicated solely to Toledo and our region is incredible, okay? Times that by the 200 plus interns that we've had over the last 5 years. That's crazy. You know how many hours of work is being put into thinking about Toledo and our region? These students are funded from the universities across the nation, and those dollars are then being reinvested here in Toledo, which is crazy. They've received hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of funding and scholarships to be working here in Toledo, which is outside dollars coming here, by the way. Okay, the work hours alone, their minds, their hearts, their time, but also the fact that they're being exposed to Toledo, and Toledo is going to be on their map for the rest of their lives. What does it mean to shape the next generation of thinkers for the sake of our nation? I think that means that you need individuals who are familiar with what America actually looks like. I would argue, as Mayor Wade Capsicavage says all the time, that Toledo is an average place for average people. Now, is that what I always want to be? Maybe, maybe not. But for individuals who are going to go on to shape our nation, okay? We're talking about future political leaders. We're talking about future researchers. We're talking about future academics, future journalists, future writers, future engineers. I mean, future data scientists, future communicators, storytellers. I mean, these are Princeton kids, Harvard kids, UCLA, UChicago. I mean, the brightest of the bright that are going to have a better understanding of the complexities of cities like Toledo and bring that into the future. I mean, to me, that's huge.
Education is not the only way to success, as we know, or meaning, right? So, but I do think that at the end of the day, the people who are making decisions are people who are, frankly, educated and are able to think critically on those issues that involve everyone. And I think that is exactly the demographic that sometimes we, first of all, we don't have in Toledo, and also sometimes we're allergic to in Toledo. I think of the students that we attract, like you all. You guys are educated, well-educated, brilliantly smart. Deya's really, really smart. And like Yannick, you know, I'm trying to keep Yannick here. I can't keep him. You know, and that's a very question that I ask to you fellows as well, and anybody that we engage with is, how the heck can I keep you guys here? Because a salary is not going to cut it.
Well, cat's out of the bag. For this whole series, Deya and I have been the ones asking that question to current and former Toledoans. But at the same time, we've been asking ourselves that question too. What would keep us in Toledo? For the longest time, my answer was Midstory. More specifically, it was this podcast. Brain Drain brought me here, and for a year, it shaped every part of my life in Toledo. Every day, my work was meaningful. The people around me really cared about me. But after work, I'd go home and feel exactly the way that so many of the young people we interviewed felt. Adrift and alone, torn between this place and the next.
I have a longer history in Toledo than Yannick does, but I've still felt that push and pull. In the 4 years since I moved back, I've watched so many of my friends pack up and leave. At the same time, my roots have grown deeper. I feel more attached to my community, maybe even proud of it, too.
What's most important is that we gain real relationships and we keep them. And then I get you to start thinking about bigger things, about this region and what you can do to make a difference. If I can do that, I mean, I'm not looking at the numbers. I'm not looking at whether you stay or not. I'm not looking at what impact you're really making, how much money you're bringing back to Toledo. No, I do believe that we're making that impact in your hearts and your minds. That's what I really care about.
You've established yourselves and established that reason for being here in Toledo, that connection between Midstory and the city. But I guess I'm wondering if you guys ever think about a time beyond Midstory, a time after you feel like you don't need to do this work anymore, or there's something else that you're more excited to do. Would that realization draw you away from this city, or do you feel like you're here for good?
It's funny because I spent most of my life prior to being in Toledo elsewhere. My dad is what you would call, like, in my earlier years, a missionary. So we moved around quite a bit. And so the idea of like home was always kind of like this thing that you were seeking after. So yeah, maybe it's like not about Midstory and it's not about Toledo, but the sort of like the ecosystem, the problem statement that it's set up for us allows us to embark on that. To answer that question for this time of our lives. Maybe the Toledo that we're talking about now won't be here in the next 10 years. It'll be different, you know? And so the place that we have to grapple with might also be different. And I feel like that's also a very exciting thing if we have the eyes to actually see that.
Are you Toledo lifers now?
Are we Toledo lifers? I don't know. But I will say that in some ways, yes. You know, I mean, our heart is always for the city and for the region, you know. And
it's funny because you don't get to pick it.
No, you don't.
You don't get to pick where you're from.
Nope.
You know.
But so. I think we can make real impact. I mean, I'm glad we're in Toledo and not Cleveland, frankly. Right? I mean, we had this discussion quite a bit. What if we just moved to Cleveland? So, you know, there's always that challenge. But we think Toledo is a really interesting place and lovely place to live and to be a home base for the narrative that's really Midstory. At the core of this is, I think that really is the Midwest narrative. It's like not that great, it's not that bad, but there's got to be something behind all that that's worth something.
This series has been my life for the last 16 months in many more ways than one. And the end seems like the right time to admit to you all that I'm not in Toledo anymore. These words are coming to you from the depths of my bedroom closet in Los Angeles. Maybe I am just another person that left, one drop in a 50-year tide. But I am also a person that has come away with a bigger understanding of this city. Toledo will always be on my map. Before I go, I've got a personal note from Sam, Ruth, Logan, and the Midstory team. A letter written to you, to me, to all of us who are in pursuit of brighter tomorrows.
Over the course of this podcast, you've heard from dozens of Toledoans. The transplants, the born and bred, the ones who've stayed, the ones who've left, the ones who've returned. You've heard their stories, their complaints and their praises, their histories and their dreams. And we'll ask of you one thing. Listen. You've heard from Daya, who is about to start a family of her own right here in Toledo. You've heard from Yannick, who's moved to LA and is off enjoying sunshine and beaches while we trek through a Great Lakes winter. And now you've heard from us, who've dedicated what might just be one of the best decades of our lives to this city. Not just to sing its praises or to find a comfortable place to live, but to dig our heels stubbornly in this swamp, to face our challenges head on, to spearhead solutions in a real and meaningful way. Why are we still here? If we had a nickel for every time we've been asked that question, it'd be much easier to keep the lights on here at Midstory. The truth is, we've had to make our own way here, to fight for our own reason to stay. We're not here to advance our careers. We're certainly not here to make money. And we're not even here to try to save a dying city. We probably couldn't, even if we tried. But we're here because we believe in humanity. Because we believe in Toledo. Because we believe in change. Because we believe in all those who want to fulfill their callings. Because we believe in you.
Brain Drain is a Midstory podcast written and hosted by Daya Kukeli and by me, Yannick Schaller. Our editors are Logan Sander and Samuel Chang.
Sound design and engineering on this episode is by Yannick Schaller. Original artwork for the series by Ruth Chang and Joshua Rep. Data analysis by Taisha Tsui, Anna Diasio, and Yitong Jung. Fact checking by Terry Brisky.
Special thanks go to our lovely team of interns who called Toledo home for, at least, a summer. Anna B. Prakash, Yasu Shinazaki, Rajan Carson, Martin Barreto, and Desiree Lua.
For more information, research, and reading material, please check out the show notes for this episode, available at midstory.org/braindrain. If our reporting has struck a chord or a nerve, we want to hear from you. Reach us on social media or via email at braindrain@midstory.org.
As this is our final episode, we'd also like to extend our thanks to all of the Toledoans who spoke with us over the last 16 months. Your perspectives, your effort, and your care made this series what it is. It was an honor to hear you give voice to this city. And last but not least, to everyone tuning in, thanks for listening.
Today, few people learn about President Lincoln's opponents in the North. They've been forgotten in favor of a story that paints Lincoln as a national hero. But his opponents, called the Copperheads, were very real and very dangerous. In collaboration with the Confederates, a group of Copperheads hatched a plan to free some of the hundreds of thousands of Confederate prisoners held in Northern jails. Their ultimate goal was ever bolder: to take over the state governments of Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois, and establish a Northwestern Confederacy. journalist Dan Gettyman set out to tell this forgotten story in The Copperhead Conspiracy, a recently released podcast produced in collaboration with Ohio Humanities. He chats with reporter Celia Johnson about why this episode of history remains relevant today. Here is that story.
In the podcast, you talk about how this is a, you know, not very well-known part of American history. So how did you stumble into this story?
So I learned about this story while working on another podcast that I produced called The Reckoning, Facing the Legacy of Slavery in America, which your listeners can go look for on all the various podcast platforms. And while that series was all about, in particular, the history of slavery in Kentucky, where I live. And I told the story through two families, a white enslaver family and a black family that was enslaved by the white family. And I picked the white family because there was an enormous treasure trove of correspondence, letters between the various family members. And I noticed that there were no letters to or from one family member, whereas there were a ton with all the other family members. And I thought, why is that? And so I wanted to just learn a little bit about this missing family member, a guy named Joshua Bullitt. And I just put his name in Google. And one of the first things that popped up was a New York Times article about his arrest for treason. He was tried in a military tribunal and that he was eventually exiled out of the country and ended up in Canada. And I found out that he had been the highest ranking jurist in Kentucky. He was the Chief Justice of the Appellate Court and from a very wealthy and powerful family. And what he was arrested for was this conspiracy. And it turned out he was the leader of it in the state of Kentucky, that he was part of a fraternal organization, secret society called the Sons of Liberty. And they patterned themselves quite literally off of the Sons of Liberty that your listeners may be familiar with from the Revolutionary War. They believed it was their responsibility to follow in the footsteps of the Revolutionary War era Sons of Liberty, and where they saw tyranny in the United States, they needed to act. And if violence was necessary, so be it. So I just, you know, I'm a journalist. And as I read about this guy, I started just pulling this thread and learned about his various associates and learned about this movement. And the weird thing that I found was there was almost nothing in any contemporary American history books about this phenomenon. However, if I went to old history books that were written in the late 19th and early 20th century, there's whole chapters on it. There's whole books on it. And every one of the major anniversaries after the events that the series talks about in the 1860s, the 10th anniversary, the 25th anniversary, the 50th anniversary, there would be major articles in major publications like the Atlantic Monthly, like Harper's Magazine, the New York Times, etc., talking about this, like, incredibly important moment in American history that almost changed the course of the Civil War and thus American history.
Well, that's all super interesting. And now, you know, you and I have mentioned the Copperheads a couple times. You talked about the Sons of Liberty earlier, but let's talk about this overarching group that titles the podcast.
So the Copperheads were a coalition of people in the United States, in the northern part of the United States, during the Civil War. And what they had in common was an aversion to Abraham Lincoln and his Republican administration and the aims of the federal government in the Civil War. So this coalition, came together for different reasons, but they all had the same aim. And that is, they believed the war should end immediately, that there should be a negotiated peace, that the South should be allowed to secede and go off on their own, that in particular, the Union government, the U.S. government, should have no role to play in adjudicating slavery in America, and that this was yet another way that Big Brother, they didn't have that term then, but big government was getting in the way of individual liberty.
And, you know, these are northern politicians, like you said, right? They're in these Midwestern states.
not just politicians. This was very much a grassroots movement. And some of them were very highly placed. There were U.S. senators, U.S. congressmen, most notably a guy named Clement Vallandigham, who was a congressman from southern Ohio. He spoke so passionately about it in Congress, and his speeches were published widely. They were published as books. They were published in magazines and newspapers. The things he said were consequential. And so the federal government started to crack down on people expressing views that were antithetical to the policies of the U.S. government during a time of war. And they believed that they asserted martial law and basically discontinued the civil rights that were guaranteed in the Constitution and said they had to because it was a civil war and normal civil liberties do not apply.
That's very interesting. Well, you know, you talked a little bit about the live and let live mentality, and I think maybe one thing that's potentially different about this circumstance, so that you can tell me if this is also a repeating thing we see throughout history, is that some of these copperheads, you know, it wasn't just about letting the South live and let live, but they were actually, you know, working with Confederate agents to bring about the South's ideals. So is that unique in the history?
No, I don't think so. Again, going back to this notion of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, there were several members of the Copperhead movement who didn't like what the South was doing per se, okay? They may have even not thought slavery was a good idea for the country. However, they felt so strongly that a state should be allowed to secede if it strongly felt that its sovereignty was endangered by what the federal government was doing, which precisely was the argument of the colonists against the British government in the 1760s and 70s. It was exactly the same argument. Who are you to tell us what we should do over here? Okay? And even the notion of taxation without representation, right? Our money should not go to support what you up there in Washington think is the right thing to do. We should be able to make our own decisions. So that's the point where, and so again, with the enemy of my enemy is my friend, then they thought it was okay to conspire with Confederate agents because it was a means to an end. And the means to an end was to get rid of Abraham Lincoln one way or another. So first the idea was let's get rid of Lincoln through political means. Then the notion was, let's kidnap Lincoln and use him as a bargaining chip to end the war, free prisoners of the Confederacy, and return things to the status quo where they were back in 1860. And then when that didn't work, a splinter group decides, let's just kill him.
But before even that, they had a pretty audacious plan involving state governments here in the Midwest, didn't they?
Yes. So the thinking was that individual states in the Midwest, specifically Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, all had Republican governors as of the 1863 period. And they had Republican governors and predominantly Democratic legislatures. And so especially in Indiana, the governor of Indiana basically declared martial law all on his own. He shut the legislature down. Well, you can imagine how angry this made his constituents. And to a lesser degree, this happened in Ohio and Illinois. So the idea was, the big idea was, on one particular day, these copperhead paramilitary groups who were well-armed were going to rise up, assassinate the governors of these states, the Republican governors, assassinate Republican leaders in the state legislatures and put in essentially it was a coup. They'd put in their own leaders. And then the idea was these various states of the Midwest would pull away from the United States and become their own country that was going to be known as the Northwest Confederacy. They were going to ally themselves politically with the Southern Confederacy, the Confederate States of America, and there would be three countries: the Northwest Confederacy, the Confederate States of America, and the United States of America.
But of course, that plan did not come to fruition, thanks in part to some work by some spies.
Yes. So this is the birth of domestic surveillance, you know, surveilling citizens, reading their mail, reading their emails, looking at their text messages, all that stuff. That all starts in 1863, roughly, when the federal government decides we need to find out what these copperheads are doing. And so there was one guy in particular, a Kentuckian named Felix Stidger, and he was able to infiltrate into this Sons of Liberty group and report back to his commanding officer in the Union Army what was going on. And he let them know in advance, this thing, this multi-state coup is going to happen on a certain date. And so they were able to swoop in at the last minute and arrest several of the ringleaders, including the guy I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, Judge Joshua Bullitt in Kentucky, to keep them from actually activating this plan.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dan. I know you said, you know, you asked all your interviewees the same question at the end of their interviews, and we talked a little bit about this today already, but I wanted to ask you the same question, which is, you know, why is understanding this part of American history important?
Well, the major reason is because American history repeats itself over and over again in various ways. It's not exact, but it echoes, right? I'm not the first person to say this. But in researching this series, I've never been more cognizant of this phenomenon. There's an article I was just rereading. It was published in 1964. It's called The Paranoid Style in American Politics. And it basically talks about, since the birth of the United States, there's been this tendency toward conspiracy theory, tendency toward paranoid feelings that they're out to get us. Well, this was all being talked about at this time, okay? The same paranoia that if we don't nip this in the bud, we are going to become serfs. We are going to become, slaves. They used that actual terminology, okay? So they were saying, hey, you guys are worried about slavery? We're all going to be slaves. We're going to be slaves of despots like Abraham Lincoln, okay? And we've got to fight this. And Americans, especially in a sort of a mob mentality, can gather together and do almost anything to fight back, right? And sometimes in history, it seems like we fought back in a good way, right? Ken Burns' recent documentary on the Revolutionary War sheds light into all the different reasons why the so-called patriots were fighting against the British government, some of which was completely self-aggrandizing. They wanted to settle the Midwest. They wanted to have cheap land. They wanted to be able to take it away from the Indians, etc. So American history keeps repeating itself. I believe that any citizen who wants to understand what's going on today in America would do well to listen to stories like what happened during this Copperhead conspiracy to sort of better understand these threads in American history so that when they pop up again, you can recognize them for what they are.
Well, thanks so much again for joining us, Dan, and for the podcast. I certainly found it an illuminating and, yeah, you know, familiar in some ways. Listen.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Midstory Hour. We have a full lineup for our next episode, so tune in next Saturday at 10 a.m. to hear more about Midstory, our home, and our greater region. If you have a story you'd like to share or just would like to drop us a note, please contact us at contact@midstory.org. Midstory Hour is a Midstory podcast produced in collaboration with WGTE. It features original work produced by our dedicated team of reporters, researchers, data analysts, and creators. This episode was hosted by Samuel Chang, edited by Evan Blanco, and written by Logan Sander, Ruth Chang, and Samuel Chang. Artwork is by Ruth Chang and Joshua Repp. This week's episode features stories by the Greater Midstory team, including Dea Kukeli, Yannick Schaller, Celia Johnson, and Yaffa Siegel. Midstory is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to progressing the Midwest narrative through multimedia storytelling, solutions-oriented research, and community programming. Founded in 2018 by four individuals who found their way home from the East Coast to Toledo, Ohio, Midstory re-envisions the Midwest story toward a productive, bright, and influential future. Learn more at www.midstory.org.
The Midstory Hour is a weekly radio show by Midstory, where we connect regional stories to national dialogues and feature behind-the-story conversations with Midstory's writers from across the nation. Tune in to WGTE on FM 91 every Saturday at 10 a.m. and find the podcast online at midstory.org/themidstoryhour and wgte.org/themidstoryhour or wherever you listen to podcasts.